Then the horns go wah 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 wah, 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 and I go. And then you start to sing.
Whenever you're near, all my fears disappear. It's plain as can be. You're lucky to me.
So lucky, lucky, lucky to me.
My only love charms. I ought to love in arms. Anybody can see. You're lucky to me.
So lucky to me.
Yes, perfect. Nothing can happen to me anymore. I'm writing 13 all over my door. My mother and dad thought that my luck was bad. Now, like me, they agree. You're lucky to me.
Welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 26, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Matt Tamanini. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Morning.
Hello. Also with us is Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and the host of Some Like It Pop podcast, which is available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can connect with Matt on Twitter at BWWMatt. And Matt and I also do that Monday through Friday Today on Broadway thing. Hello, Matt.
Good morning. Don't remind me. Don't remind me.
It is quite the marathon race, isn't it?
Yes, but the difference is in a marathon, you know there's a finish line at some point. I think the plan is just to do this in perpetuity, which really makes me tired.
Yeah, the finish line is when we die. All right. So, Peter, we're going to take a step back from Broadway for a second and talk about I'll Say She Is. That's a tongue twister, a Marx Brothers musical. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, Noah Diamond, who is one of the great Marx Brothers fans of all time, decided that since we've seen Animal Crackers and Coconuts on the stage, that we should certainly see I'll Say She Is Too, which predated both of those properties. And given the fact that he's so good at imitating Groucho, he decided to put himself in the lead. Now, the problem was that there wasn't much of a show when he found the script. The thing was, the Marx Brothers were notorious for improvising, and as a result, they didn't need much of a script to put on a show, just the bare bones, and then they would take it from there. So what he did, which was really interesting, was going to columns of the time, what I mean is newspaper columns, and checking to see if anybody said, gee, you know, Groucho said something really funny last night from the stage, and put in the lines. And all those lines that he found in newspapers, he put into the show here, there, and everywhere. So it's a scattershot evening, no question about it. The plot, such as it is about a society woman who's out for thrills. It's about time that she leave her cloistered home and go out and see what the real world is like. Well, she gets herself into a peck of trouble. And under those circumstances, she realizes, you know, it's there's no place like home. So not much of a story there. And the joy is in watching the people playing the Marx Brothers. And I'll tell you, the thing that's remarkable about Noah Diamond is even the trajectory of the cigar is absolutely perfect. I mean, that's if you know the Marx Brothers movies, and I'll grant you a lot of people don't because they are black and white movies, and that certainly is held against them these days. You'll really be impressed to see how wonderfully apt he is with the walk, all that kind of business. Now, we've seen Groucho imitators in the past, no question about it. We've seen Louis J. Stadlin and Minnie's Boys. We've seen Frank Ferrante making a genuine career of it, doing for a long, long time. And here's the third jewel of the Triple Crown. So he is really worth seeing. Delightful score by people whose names don't mean anything to me, but really nice rikki-tikki Broadway music of the era and wonderfully sung. As I say, the two gentlemen who play Chico, it's not Chico, by the way, it's Chico because he chased chicks. God forbid they could put a K in the name, but it is Chico. And under those circumstances, you have to be impressed at the way this gentleman plays the piano, which is the way Chico did with his cute little finger shooting at the keys as much as playing them. And the harpo, of course, doesn't have any lines, but there is a sequence where he plays the harp. Frankly, I don't think he is playing the harp, but somebody is, and it comes through the house very, very nicely. So one more week for I'll Say She Is down at the Connolly Theater, not the easiest place in the world to get to on East 4th Street, but people are getting there. I'll tell you, the place was packed the day I went, and I think some of this has to do, of course, with a wonderful review in the Times, which the show really deserved. So good luck to I'll Say She Is, and good luck in getting tickets to it this week.
That's great. It's playing down at the Connolly, as you mentioned, through July 3rd, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Peter, I was looking at their website, and did I count correctly? They have 22 people in the cast?
Yeah, and not only that, wow, the budget on costumes must have been amazing. My friend Josh Ellis, who attended with me, said, you know, they should pick this right up and go to Goodspeed. It really is a Goodspeed show, and I think it's a great idea. So I hope that that happens in the future. I imagine next season, but I hope they put everything in storage so they can get it right back out again. So, yeah, it really fills the stage. A good time was had by all.
So moving on, I took some time this week to go out to Central Park and see Taming of the Shrew. And Peter talked about it a few weeks ago on This Week on Broadway. And I just have to reiterate Peter's points on it, that it just... it was a wonderful evening and some really strong performances. Janet Pintier is just amazing. And so if you do get a chance to get out there, to reserve yourself some tickets on Today's Ticks or various other ways to get yourself free tickets for this, or sit online, have a picnic out of the park, but get out there and see it. It's a very different take on Shrew that I've ever seen. And a very enjoyable evening.
James, let me ask a question here. That's about Today's Ticks. How does it work with this show?
So with Today's Ticks, you get the app on your phone, and then you log into the app, and you go down to the Taming of the Shrew, and you just press reserve tickets, and they will email you later in the day to let you know if you receive the tickets or not. It's a very pain-free, quick process, and a really interesting way for the public to get out there and be able to get tickets into people's hands in a whole other way that I've never seen before, insofar as the public goes. I mean, Today's Ticks does what do they call those things? The last minute.
The lotteries?
The lottery. Rushes. I was looking for the rush and lottery words and I couldn't find them on my tongue.
That's
Thank
what I'm
you.
Here for, James.
Yeah. You, perfect. You are just very, very good at that. So, but Today's Ticks, you can get a bunch of the lotteries, not the Hamilton lottery, but the Hamilton lotteries on BroadwayDirect.com. But many of the lotteries for the Broadway shows and off-Broadway shows are on Today's Ticks, and it's a free app, and check it out. And they do probably email me more than I would like to be emailed, but I guess that, you know, that's kind of their business model. You're trying to get something for free or low cost from them, and they are trying to get you to buy other tickets to other shows.
All right. Speaking of free, low cost, and lotteries, let's also mention that Hillary Clinton.
Oh, you yeah. Know about this? Oh, yeah. It's not free or low cost at all.
The opposite of free and low cost.
I got the impression you don't have to give a dime. You just have to enter your name into the lottery, and she may very well take you to Hamilton.
Oh, I'm talking about something else, aren't I? Matt, Hamilton's having a Tuesday morning performance as a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton with tickets up to $100,000 a seat.
I see. All right.
Yeah, there's that. I don't know if there's a lottery with that as well. I'm looking at the
article. I think that there
the
is.
Right
now that Peter mentions it, there's a different thing where Hillary will take you to Hamilton. Maybe that's for the same performance because they're covering some of their costs.
Is, yeah.
Covering some of their costs with the $100,000 seats. $100,000 seats.
What's a 100K between friends and political candidates?
That's coming up that's coming up soon. Let's see what the date
it's
is.
It's Tuesday,
July 12th, 11:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Hamilton, an American musical with special guest Hillary Rodham Clinton. General seating is $2,700 a seat. Preferred seating is $5,000. Premium seats are $10,000. But it includes a photo reception with Hillary. A host is $33,400 a seat. You get to go to the party plus the photo reception and other special guests. And then you get to be an event chair, which includes two premium seats, a wrap party with Hillary and other special guests, and an invitation to the Democratic National Convention in Cleveland.
Meanwhile, will Donald Trump rebut by giving us tickets to Perfect Crime? That's what I want to know.
I see. I'm trying to think what would be the Republican equivalent. I'm trying to think of, what show not to denigrate with a Republican tag on it.
I think Peter's was perfect. Perfect Crime is perfect. Oh, wow. But with these $2,700 general seating for this Hillary fundraiser, if you're trying to get tickets on the secondary market, this might actually be cheaper than what you could get normally.
I agree.
Which is frightening.
So, it sure is. The interesting
and that
part
brings
about
us, and that brings us something we talked about before we started, to Elizabeth Vincentelli and Jeremy Gerard, both of whom were laid off this week. And I maintain one of the reasons that the Post laid off Elizabeth has nothing to do with quality. Lord knows she was a quality reviewer. No, I haven't heard that anybody's replacing her. I think they're just going to stop doing reviews.
I think that was the take there.
And it makes sense to me why they would, because indeed I can't imagine that there are many Post readers who go to the theater anymore because it's just too expensive. This is not the readership New York Times has, and I'm not even sure how many Times readers can afford to go. Did I mention to you I went for a checkup recently with the doctor? The doctor said, well, tell me what you do. I'm a theater critic. Do you go to the theater, I asked him. He said, nah, too expensive. A doctor! If a doctor finds it too expensive, my God, So under those circumstances, I'm not surprised that the Post says, our readers just are not going to the theater, so why bother?
I think that you've hit the nail on the head, that I think that it's a big perception that the theater is too expensive. Meanwhile, people don't blink at going to a Yankee game or a Knicks game or a Rangers game, or to go to a concert at Madison Square Garden with, $200-$400 seats as well. There's many inexpensive ways to attend the theater. Certainly, just like flying an airplane, if you try to get the most sought-after ticket at the last moment, you're going to pay a fortune, absolutely. But if you plan your schedule well, you can get to see the theater very inexpensively. There's a whole website on, I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head, Seeing Theater for Cheap. And certainly there's a lot of organizations like CDF.
Some of my readers do tell me about paying $4.50 to see shows, and I'll grant you that. Lord knows they're not hits. But, that's another thing, too. There used to be the perception that a hit is good for the business, that therefore it spills over. People can't get into the hit, and under those circumstances, they will go and buy tickets to something else because they're in town. Let's go see something. We're here. On the other hand, given the fact that the Hamilton tickets are now so out of sight, right in the stratosphere. I wonder if people go to the theater and say, that's it for 5 years now. I mean, we're just not going to be able to afford anything else during this period of time. I think that Hamilton, and this is nothing against Hamilton, you know, they're doing what they're doing. You're a hit, how wonderful. But I mean, I do believe that these over-the-top prices are causing other shows to suffer. And here's have we ever seen such carnage so quickly after the Tonys as we've seen here, with so many shows throwing in the towel? Because none of the new musicals won any Tony Awards. They can't bring, you know, I mean, in the old days, you win Best Lighting and you broadcast Tony-winning musical, yeah. you know, and you can't even do that this year. I mean, Color Purple can, but, I mean, so few can. So under those circumstances, we are really seeing shows drop dead quicker than ever before, it seems to me, after the Tonys.
Matt,
Peter, we talked about... Sorry, we talked about this on Today on Broadway, that there were 11 new musicals that came out this season. And after this recent run of closings that, you know, includes Bright Star, which closes today, and then Shuffle Along, which announced its closing for next month, there's only going to be 4 still running. That seems, like you said, to be way out of the ordinary. Can you think of another season that had so many shows open and then so few make it out of the summer season?
Not offhand, it seems to me this is really the worst that we've ever experienced, because, again, nobody has Tonys to promote, and that's the real problem. So, it seems to me, even though the Tony viewership was up, I imagine that was because of Hamilton, and maybe people weren't even paying attention to the other shows, just waiting for that Hamilton show to come on. So we don't hear the usual bump that, wow, that number on the Tonys really sold tickets. I haven't heard that about any show this year. It may be that some shows did get that bump. All I'm saying is I didn't hear about it, and I do.
Yeah, well, and we talked about it again, that the one number that probably would give the show a bump was the Color Purples, but the week immediately following the Tonys, and I think this probably proved to be a big mistake, they let Cynthia Erivo go on vacation, and it took a huge dip in the box office last week. So hopefully this week, now that she's back on Monday when we get the grosses, it comes back. But that's the show that it seems to me would have gotten the biggest bump, and it didn't because of, you know, frankly, poor scheduling.
Yeah.
So, Matt, one of your favorite John F. Kennedy quotes is the rising tide lifts all ships, isn't it?
I do like that one, yes.
And but we might see that a rising tide is making everybody drowned.
Yeah.
But, you know, flashback to, you know, what we talked about to, you know, maybe 5 minutes ago, you know, Shakespeare in the Park is free. So you can see a good show for next to nothing or nothing. And there are other ways of doing things. I don't know if what Peter was, you had said before about spending so much money on a single show and saying that's it for the year. You know, what my experience is that, you know, my wife and I would take our kids to go do something and we have a really good time. We want to find out, hey, What else can we do that's similar to this, since this was such a good investment? But I guess it is all a reflection of how much disposable income you have to do those things. And that's,
well, not only that, but the, you know, we talk about all the things you can do for cheaply, the TDF, the TKTS, all of these different things. But for people who aren't as engrossed in the theater community as we are, or as many of our listeners are, they don't know what that is. They don't know how to do that. So like you're talking about with Yankees games, finding cheap, you know, sporting event tickets is much easier than finding cheap theater tickets. You've got to be a part of this club. You've got to subscribe to this. You've got to go wait in line. People don't know how to do these things. So you guys living in New York would know much better than I would. If we really are going to try to promote these other discount options so people don't feel like they're priced out of going to the theater, they probably need to pump a little more money in just to the marketing of getting these options out there. So people know if they're planning a trip to New York, it's not, you know, $2,700 to Hamilton or $200 to the Lion King or however much it is to Wicked. You can also get a cheap ticket to a good show if you put in a little work, or if you go to this thing that's off the beaten track. And I, as much as I love, you know, Telecharge and everything they do, I almost feel like they're now, they obviously don't have tickets to every Broadway show, but they've conditioned the Broadway ticket buying audience that you have to come through us. We have to be the ones you get your tickets from. Otherwise, you don't know if you're going to get real tickets, yada, yada, yada. It's almost conditioned people to only get tickets from that source. So they ignore some of the other options where they can get cheaper tickets, which is great for Telecharge and, you know, the Schuberts and everyone who's behind that. But it might, you know, had the unintended consequence that people might then stay away from because they don't know how to get cheaper tickets that fit into their budget when they're planning a trip into New York.
You were talking before about what happens with large shows that have a runaway hit and how it affects the season. In the 2000-2001 season, there were 11 musicals that opened up. 42nd Street, A Class Act, Bells Are Ringing, Blast, Follies, Jane Eyre, The Full Monty, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, Seussical, The Rocky Horror Show, and The Producers. And as we know, The Producers won a ton of awards there, and many of those other shows got swept away, as did what happened in this season as well. So I don't know. I think that there's something to be said for being able to market a Tony Award to keep the show going. And I don't know if... Seussical toured, but I didn't think the tour was a resounding success.
Seussical's success has come after all that ended.
Yeah, it's in the secondary market, yeah.
No question. I will admit that that it does rhyme with the word musical, but Seussical is the only money-losing show that's mentioned in the Something Rotten sequence, the big song, A Musical. That's the only one that wasn't a hit. And again, yes, I'm sure the tail wagged the dog and they had a rhyme and that they were going to use it. I understand that. Still, if the show had not resonated with audiences around the country as it has, one of the few shows ever to have such a disastrous Broadway run and then really climb out of the muck and become such a success in the, as you say, secondary market. It's just amazing to me how so many people in the hinterland said, we don't care that it failed on Broadway. It makes no difference to us whatsoever. We are doing this show and that's all there is to it. And that usually doesn't happen with, you should pardon the expression, flops. So it was really something very healthy that the rest of the country didn't care what happened on Broadway.
Getting back to our original discussion about Jeremy Gerard and Elizabeth Vincentelli, Jeremy Gerard, we didn't mention, from Deadline.com, also laid off in criticism. It doesn't look like Deadline is going to be replacing a legitimate reviewer, as well as Deadline seems to be. Deadline's real name is Deadline Hollywood. They seem to be more film and television oriented than musical theater. But this is certainly two very highly qualified who are mainstays in the theatrical community, and it's astounding again to see the pool of criticism narrowing, and hopefully they will show up at other outlets who have decided to make an investment into theatrical criticism. Peter, you also got a chance to see himself and Nora, so why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a pleasant little show about James Joyce and the woman he loved, named Maura. She was quite a firecracker for her era, certainly much more interested in free love than so many of her contemporaries. So it deals with their relationship, their ups and downs, the good times, the bad times, the ugly times. Jonathan Brielle, that's not his real name, by the way. He comes from Brielle, New Jersey. When I interviewed him, I said, thank God you don't come from Manalapan. You know, I mean, you'd be Jonathan Manalapan, you know. So anyway, has written the book Music and Lyrics. And while I can't say that the book is terribly arresting because it does tell a story that seems familiar. The music is quite lovely. I'd love to see him do another musical and really concentrate on the music. And the lyrics are fine, too, most of the time. So, but what beautiful, beautiful melodies he's been able to create. Matt Bogart is doing a terrific job as James Joyce. Now, this is a leave of absence for him because the show was supposed to only run until September. And he, for the longest time, and I mean the longest time, has been with Jersey Boys. But luckily they let him out. And it's very nice how most shows do this. They do let their people out to do things that they're interested in doing. So he's been able to extricate himself from Jersey Boys for a little bit of time and is doing a bang-up job in this role. He's really, really quite wonderful. And Whitney Bashor is the name of the actress who's playing Nora, and she's just lovely and accomplished and really holds stage very, very well. It's certainly a name that we should take into our consciousnesses. I mean,
she's fantastic.
Done. Oh, you know who she is?
I do. No, I've never seen her in person, but she's – are you familiar with the Pasek and Paul musical Edges?
Sure.
When it's one of the first shows, she was in, I believe, the first professional production, and that video, those videos are all over YouTube. So she's been one of my favorites for years, just having watched those videos of she did the songs In Short and Perfect, and they are incredible. Two of my favorite videos to go back to and watch. So I'm so glad that you enjoyed her.
Oh, that's very interesting to me, too. I wonder if I saw her in Edges. I saw Edges at White Plains, the White Plains Performing Arts Center. I don't know if that's the same production.
Sure.
Yeah. But anyway, she's really quite wonderful. And she's really worth seeing. Also, Michael McCormack, who's a marvelous character actor, is in the show as well. You can't go wrong if you hire Michael, who really knows his way around the stage and plays a multitude of roles, as do three other people, too. Now, this is a show that I saw in Rahway, New Jersey, and I am pretty sure, I'm not going to put any money on it, but I am pretty sure that at that time there were only two other people who were supporting in the cast, and now we're up to four. If that turns out to be untrue, don't be the slightest bit surprised, but if memory serves, and it often doesn't, they've really tried to buttress it up. So Michael Bush, the director, has tried to do better by the show by having two other people in it, I think. Anyway, a nice job all around, and certainly worth seeing for the two leads and to hear that music. I know there's a CD, and if you can't get to the Minetta Lane Theater, do consider getting that CD, and I think you'll be very nicely pleased by the Irish-tinged music.
All right, so we'll have to check that out. You also got over to the Lion Theater where you saw Phoenix Rising. So tell us about that.
Well, this is a show about abused women who meet in a group every now and then, I guess every week, and they talk about their problems, and there are a lot of conflicts among the women in the group. To use another sports analogy, these two teams don't like each other, and this is a case where many of the women in the group don't like each other, and they have to be calmed down by a woman who is running the group, who has this wonderfully calming voice. She really does a very nice job in sounding as if nothing's wrong, it's all going to work out. After a while, you get a little tired of that because you do feel it's more complicated than just having a calming voice and saying what always seems to be the right thing. And it seems a little too pat. Part of the problem, too, is that there are fantasy sequences which are done in rhymed couplets. And by the way, the show starts that way. with the women all looking out at us and looking as if they're in a reverie. And each of them gives a little bit of a speech in a rhyme couplet. And you think, uh-oh, this is what it's going to be all night long. No, it's not. Once they get into the encounter group, then it's genuine prose. But they do return to this every now and then, and that gets a little wearing, too. So I wish I could be more enthusiastic about Phoenix Rising, but I can't. It means well. It certainly tells some harrowing stories, none of which are very pleasant, of course, if we're going to talk about abuse of young women who certainly have problems with neighbors, friends, relatives, parents. And you get the point. And that's what it's all about. 90 minutes, no intermission. I have a feeling they might lose some of their audience had they had an intermission. So, as I say, I wish I could be more enthusiastic, but I simply cannot.
All right. On to television and film. Matt, you got a chance to see the NT Live production of One Man, Two Governors with James Corden. So tell us about that.
I did. That show's a ton of fun. And I had seen and I think reviewed the show back in 2014 at the now sadly defunct Georgia Shakespeare Theater. So I knew what I was getting into. This seemed, maybe because it was the British production of the show, it was a little harder to break through some of the accents. But other than that, that's such a fun show. And for me, the attraction, because I'd seen the show, you know, in person at a quality regional theater, the attraction for me was to see James Corden in the role that he eventually won a Tony for, especially because who knows if we'll ever see James Corden on stage again, and if so, how long it will be, because he has really taken the late night world by storm with the Late Late Show, and there's already rumors that he could be replacing Stephen Colbert at 11:30 sooner rather than later. So for me, it was great to see this performance preserved on film, and he was just fantastic. He had such a great rapport with the audience, and as I'm sure both of you remember, there's so much interplay with the audience. It comes off as unscripted. It's obviously scripted, but so much of it is about how he can give that air of relatability between being a performer in the show and being the audience's, you know, cipher on stage. And it was a great performance. I love these NT Live things. There's a couple more of them coming up that I want to talk about, but I was really pleased to be able to see it. And just to see James Corden do the thing that, you know, brought him to American fame, because as demanding as a late night talk show is, I'm not sure that we'll see him on stage anytime soon.
Yeah, yeah. I remember he was supposed to do Pseudolus and Funny Thing.
Yeah.
And then the show came along and that was the end of that. There was even an oblique reference to it at the Tonys, you may recall, that he didn't wind up doing Funny Things. So maybe that will be in his future, but it doesn't look it, does it?
No, I mean, it's tough. Go ahead, James.
No, go ahead. What you were saying, Matt.
I was just saying, you're right. It doesn't look like it because he films his show in L.A. And even though they get a decent amount of weeks off in a year, they're usually strung across, you know, a week here, a week there throughout the season. So it's tough to imagine that other than maybe a Hollywood Bowl concert thing. It's tough to imagine that he'll get enough time to actually do a proper stage show either in L.A. or New York or London anytime while that show's still going, unless he's able to work it into his contract. And I think he's going to be making way too much money to be able to do that.
Yeah.
It's exactly what I was going to say, was that they shoot James Corden's show in L.A. And I was pondering whether they could bring it to New York. But, you know, L.A. is where all the stars are for Hollywood. Well, and that's what makes his show.
And especially the other three late night shows are all in New York now. Yeah. You've got Fallon, Colbert, and Seth Meyers are all in New York. So I would be shocked if they didn't have at least one of the major. Kimmel is in L.A. as well, but you know, to only have two of the five late night shows based in Hollywood is such a stark contrast from what it was, you know, a decade ago.
Sure.
It's funny. When I mentioned, when did I see True? Was it Wednesday night? I think I saw Wednesday night True. Colbert was there in the audience watching True, as a number of other celebrities, Glenn Close and a few other folks were there as well. So it'd be tough to, like you said, bring the only West Coast show to New York. But if he replaces Colbert, maybe they could have another show in there. But he's been Corden's been doing all these very funny, aside from the taxi karaoke or whatever it's called. They do that. Matt, have you seen these shows that they put on at the intersections?
Oh, yeah.
At the stoplight?
Oh, they're great.
What are they called?
Yeah, they've done. I think it's just Crosswalk Musicals where they done. They started with Grease. They've done Lion King. They're just great. It's just he takes some actors.
Who was in the Lion King?
It was Seth Rogen and Byrne, who was just in You Can't Take It With You, Rose Byrne. It was so much fun. They just run out at a stoplight, and it's just the street right outside the CBS studios there. So they run outside, do a number, and as soon as the light changes back to green, they run out of the way. It's a lot of fun, and he does great stuff. And that's why I think we might have a new, Tony host, for a long time. I think I would be shocked, especially with him being on CBS, that he doesn't kind of inherit the mantle from NPH for the next few years to kind of be the guy that they go to on a regular basis. Because I think he did a great job in the broadcast, but it also helps with their brand. He's a Tony winner who has a show on their network, and he does a lot of musical and theater related bits on his show. I think it's a perfect fit. And I was shocked when they didn't name Stephen Colbert as the host of the Tonys last year when they made that announcement. But it seems like they knew what they were doing, and this turned out to be a huge, huge win for them in all facets.
Yeah, it's very exciting. You also wanted to talk about Kenneth Branagh's theater company's Romeo and Juliet. Yeah. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, there's a couple more of these. They're not live streams. They're filmed live theater productions and then streamed into movie theaters. Kenneth Branagh Theater Company's Romeo and Juliet, which is running right now, is going to come to movie theaters through Fathom Events on July 7th at 7:30 p.m. local time. That'll star Downton Abbey's Lily James and Game of Thrones' Richard Madden. They starred together in Disney's Cinderella a year or two ago. So if you saw that and liked their chemistry, check that out. This production is directed by both Kenneth Branagh and Rob Ashford. And this seems a little odd to me, so I had to double check that it was correct. But Derek Jacobi is playing Mercutio. So not exactly the age bracket that you would normally consider for that role. But I thought that was really interesting. And then later in July, NT Live, this year, through the rest of the year, they're doing an encore series, which is why we got One Man, Two Governors. And the next one for them is their rebroadcasting or rescreening Helen Mirren's NT live production of The Audience on July 19th at 7 p.m. local time. I went and saw that last summer when it was in theaters here. And as you guys both know from the Broadway version, it's just such a remarkable performance and such a great piece of theater to see. So I was really taken by it. And I very well might go see it again. They're doing more throughout the year again. They're doing the Benedict Cumberbatch Hamlet. They're also doing the Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller Frankenstein, which they've done in years past as well. So that's really exciting. And I think we'd be remiss not to mention Broadway HD this week is doing the first ever live stream of a Broadway show with She Loves Me at 8 p.m. on June 30th, which I've already got my ticket for. James, we're recording either early or late for today on Broadway that day because I will be sitting in front of the screen. I might just hook up my computer to my TV and watch that way. So I'm really excited for that. And we talked earlier about how expensive it is and how hard it is to get people excited about the theater. These things are ways for people to see really quality theatrical productions at a fairly cheap rate. It's more expensive than going to a movie, these NT Live things. I think it's about $20. Then you throw in, popcorn and soda or whatever. Yeah. But it's still not approaching the $2,700 you're going to pay to watch Hamilton with Hillary. So, and then Broadway HD is $10 to watch this. So I'm hoping that as this becomes a little more prevalent and the technology becomes a little more accessible, that producers are able to find a way to monetize this because, it could help a lot of shows, especially as we see more limited runs of plays and musicals, so it's not necessarily hurting the box office, but it also helps these shows – have a life outside of it. If people can go and say, hey, I saw this movie or I saw this live stream, let's produce it here. That's got to be valuable to the rights holders in some way. Like you were talking about with Seussical, Peter, that that show did not have a huge run, but because of the name and because of the cast recording, it has a life. So I have to imagine that somewhere there's some producer out there who can figure out a way to make this cost effective and have a long-term strategy to make this benefit the brand of that show, out in the regional theaters and educational theaters, whatever their property is.
So I have two questions, one for Peter and one for Matt here. With all these productions going to movie theaters, The Audience and Kenneth Branagh's Romeo and Juliet, One Man, Two Governors, She Loves Me. Peter, do you think that Jeremy Gerard and Elizabeth Vincentelli could become film reviewers?
Wouldn't that be something? Yeah, I guess that possibility does exist. Wouldn't it be something if we have this whole new market of people reviewing these specifically? I guess there are too few of them, and I know your tongue is in your cheek. But still, this is going to be part of any reviewers who are left. We'll be doing this as well. Matt, Merrily We Roll Along, was that from the same company that did... One Man, et cetera, et cetera. Because that Merrily was a big hit here at the Ziegfeld, God rest its soul. When it happened, I mean, that place was virtually packed. And I remember then going to see From Here to Eternity, which had about 40 people there. So Merrily was a big success. Again, it may not be the same company, but it certainly was a big enough success that I would think that would be an encore as well.
Yeah, it was not NT Live, but it was Fathom Events is kind of the U.S. home to get the clearinghouse. So it was cinema live and digital theater, but it did come through Fathom Events like NT Live and Kenneth Branagh's shows do as well. So not the original origin company, but the American wing of it is, yes.
Uh-huh.
And Matt, my question for you is that our Today on Broadway listeners will know that you live in Orlando, but This Week on Broadway listeners may not know you live in Orlando, the weather yesterday was 106 degrees. So I know that you're sacrificing yourself to go to air-conditioned movie theaters to watch these things. What's your experience when you're in Orlando and seeing something like One Man, Two Governors? Is it a full theater?
No, it is nowhere close to the experience that Peter had going to the Ziegfeld. There's usually, and I've gone and seen these things both when I lived in Atlanta and when I live here, since I've lived here in Orlando, and you get maybe a dozen folks in there. But you got to remember, they're usually on Tuesday or Wednesday nights, and, you know, that taking one theater out is you know, not a huge hit for those local movie theaters because they probably won't have that many people in that random theater anyway, especially when you're paying $20. You're buying the concessions, but it's not, you know, it's a lot of people who are just kind of either there by themselves or, you know, one or two people that have some sort of interest in theater, but they aren't definitely your typical moviegoers who are going to be, you know, shelling out $11-$12 to see a new Avengers movie. So it's a smaller crowd, which makes me, you know, a little nervous about the long-term potential of having those things in theaters. But I know it's a fairly loyal crowd, so it's not necessarily that I see the same people every time because they play at various theaters and I go to different ones depending on, you know, what's going on. But, you know, I think the people that go, those that 12 to 20 people that go to that theater every time are probably going to go for most of them. So I hope that my experience is the outlier and that most of them have more, but I have a feeling that outside of bigger cities like New York and LA and Chicago, that you're probably not going to see huge crowds at those things, unfortunately.
You've been involved with some of your local theaters down in the Orlando area. Do they get together and go see these type of things in the theaters together or arrange things?
Not that I know of.
A lot of meetup groups groups here in New York plan theater-related type of trips. I wonder if there's a way to that these Fathom or digital digital theater is are able to build up an audience through doing those types of things, a local ground game, if it were like an election.
Yeah, no, that's a really good idea. There's a theater down here, and I know these are everywhere. It's more of an art house theater that has that serves food and stuff in your seats or whatever, called the Enzian, that actually does a lot of these screenings. They don't usually do them on the big Fathom events where, you know, it's this one day at this time. They usually do them a couple months after the fact. So it's like they're kind of like the secondary live stream screening market. So they do that down here, and those usually do much better there than they do in the big normal movie cinemaplexes. But I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think for anybody listening outside of the big cities, if you want to get a group together, that's a great way to ensure that the movie theaters in your area continue to program these things into their schedules. Because if their people don't show up, what's the incentive for them to do it? And I would hate for that to happen, A, here in Orlando, but B, anywhere, because it's another way to encourage these things to get made and these productions and these performances to get preserved on film. And so that people who don't get a chance to see it, whether it's in London or New York or maybe potentially in Chicago, maybe Steppenwolf will do it eventually, or something at the Mark Taper over in LA, to get to see these things, because there's great work being done in so many places that theater fans just can't get to everything. We can't all be James Marino and Peter Felicia and see every major show that ever happens, you know? So the opportunity to see these on film is something that I hope we can figure out a way to support and make financially viable and get people the opportunity to see as much as humanly possible.
I would think that shows like One Man, Two Governors, or even Romeo and Juliet would be great things for high school groups, either English classes or theater groups, high school theater classes, to come see these things. It's a huge learning experience. I hope that somebody can organize and get together those things. A lot of people don't realize that the business model of movie theaters are that they make all their money on concessions. They make hardly anything on the ticket sales themselves. So the ticket sales generally go back to the film producers, and all the money is being made on concessions. So it's important to not sneak in your own stuff into the movie theaters. Although, you know, we sneak them into the Broadway theaters because the Schuberts really don't need $10 for a bottle of water. But, so Hairspray Live is coming up with Kristen Chenoweth.
Yeah, I think Michael mentioned this last week when it was still a rumor, and it's been confirmed that Kristen Chenoweth is going to play Velma Von Tussle in the Hairspray Live on NBC in December. She joins a star-studded cast, and what's really interesting is that you've got three Tony winners, and Harvey Fierstein, he's got four Tonys. You've got Martin Short as Wilbur, and now you've got Kristen as Velma. Then you've got an Emmy winner and Derek Huff playing Corny Collins, and Jennifer Hudson, who's an Oscar winner and a Grammy winner. And then you've got Maddie Baleo, who's going to be, you know, this new big star playing why can't I think of her name?
Tracy.
There you go. Thank you, Peter. So it's a very good cast, and obviously Kenny Leon, a Tony winner, is directing, and Jerry Mitchell, a Tony winner, is choreographing. So it's a talent packed production already. So if you hadn't heard, Kristen's joining, and I would imagine that as these months go on, I will start to hear more, because the schedule for these NBC musicals has been, they start rehearsing about 3 months out. So with this show happening, I believe, on December 7th, you should start rehearsing in early September. And obviously, depending on the role, they don't rehearse from the very beginning. But I would imagine that some of these other parts, like Penny and Amber and Seaweed and Little Inez, we'll start to hear who those actors are here in the next couple months, which is really exciting. Then something else we've talked about with NBC on Today on Broadway, if you guys hadn't heard, if you don't listen to our daily show, they did announce that Scott Ellis from Roundabout will be directing the live production of A Few Good Men on NBC, which is aiming to air in February of 2017. They don't exactly know the time or the date specifically, and they haven't announced any cast, but the fact that they've named a director and they're setting a tentative timetable for February is exciting to see for the first time in a long time, a live play on Broadway. They also haven't said exactly how the teleplay is going to bridge the gap between the film and the stage production. And James, we've talked about that, but Aaron Sorkin is going to be adapting it. So I'm sure it'll have elements of both where they do differ.
All right. Next up in the film section, we're talking about La La Land? Tell us about La La Land.
There's a couple movies coming up over the rest of this year that have theater connections that are getting a lot of early Academy Award buzz. And I just wanted to kind of run through a few of them. I'll start with La La Land because it's the one that I'm most excited about. This is a new musical that is going to be written and directed by Damien Chazelle, who is most known for 2014's Whiplash. He also wrote 10 Cloverfield Lane, which is my favorite movie of the year so far. But it's kind of an ode to old Hollywood golden age musicals. It's starring Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. Also features Whiplash star J.K. Simmons, who's also a Broadway alum as well, along with Finn Wittrock, who is a Broadway alum who I think was just announced for a show coming back. Also has John Legend in it. This one is screening first. It's opening up the Venice Film Festival this summer and is scheduled for a December 2nd release. So anytime you see a movie with big stars in it getting released in December, you know they're thinking that's award bait. So I'm really excited to see how this one turns out. It's an original movie musical with some big stars and people that I love. So that's really exciting. Another one that I wanted to talk about is Fences. And James, we've talked about this being an HBO product. The word is now that it's actually going to be filmed for the screen. And in fact, filming started in April. And they're so excited about this production, which has Denzel Washington and Viola Davis reprising their Broadway roles. Denzel is directing. Tony Kushner has written the screenplay. They're actually planning on getting this released before the end of this year so it can be considered for the 2017 Oscars. It's filming in Pittsburgh as we speak. It started, like I said, at the end of April. So this is one for theater fans to keep an eye on. It's been something that people have wanted to adapt for the screen for a long time, but August Wilson's insistence for anything that filmed of his work was that it had to be directed by an African-American director. And so to have Denzel Washington, who obviously has such a long history of working with August Wilson's shows on stage, kind of helming that as one of the biggest stars in the world, I would imagine that this is going to be a high-quality production. Scott Rudin, who we often talk about on Today on Broadway, is one of the producers, is the lead producer. So this should be really great. And then one that is probably – it's already being talked about as completing the EGOT for Lin-Manuel Miranda, although I think – throw in the Pulitzer and the Olivier he won this year. I think we can call it a P-Goot. But that's Mona from Disney, which is the new Disney musical that he wrote some of the music for. It stars Dwayne The Rock Johnson as one of the people. Also, Hamilton's Philippa Sue is in there as well. It has to do with a little girl in Hawaii who meets a god, for lack of a better term, a demigod played by The Rock. So it seems like it's going to be one of those that's just going to ride the wave of success, not only of Hamilton, but Frozen as well. That's going to be released on November 23rd. It looks really, really fun. There's some teaser trailers out. So keep an eye out on that. And then, Peter, I wanted to ask you, how much do you know about Florence Foster Jenkins?
Yeah, certainly when I used to go into record stores, there would always be that album, The Glory, and there were question marks of the human voice. And I remember my late great friend David Wolf saying, you know, this should be a musical because the actual picture on the cover of her dressed as an angel, he said, is a perfect logo for a Broadway musical. And of course, we all came to know her through Souvenir, which was a play that Judy Kaye did some years ago. And while it wasn't a smash hit by any stretch of any imagination, it certainly did decently enough and spurred a lot of regional productions. There was also a play in London that on the same subject, not the same play, but the same subject. And now, of course, Meryl Streep is doing Florence Foster Jenkins, exactly, the movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, Peter.
Oh, you didn't. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Good. Yeah. That's what I was leading to. Exactly. The new Meryl Streep movie, Florence Foster Jenkins, will be released on August 12th. It's gotten fairly good reviews so far, mostly, as always, praising Meryl Streep's performance as an heiress in New York who owns her own music club and aspires to be an opera singer, but maybe doesn't have the talent necessarily for it. Also co-stars Hugh Grant, Nina Arianda, Broadway favorite, and Tony Winter is in the cast as well. So that's one to keep an eye on as well. And as Peter kind of outlined, a long connection to other properties on Broadway. So those are some movies to keep in mind as you're thumbing through the listings to find something to do on a weekend throughout the rest of 2016.
So that's exciting. You said that Fences started filming in the end of April. I think they probably have to be done filming because that's eight weeks of filming for basically an interior shot. They must be finished already. Yeah,
it could be. I have not heard if they finished, but again, you never know. You know, a lot of times interior movies get turned into much different, or interior plays get turned into something much different when they get filmed for screen. It started filming just about 8 weeks ago. So if they do finish, I would imagine they have to finish soon if they want to get that edited and pieced together for a presumably December release in time for the Academy Award consideration.
Yeah, I'm more or less thinking along the lines of what the costs are per every day of filming, of keeping the crew together and the actors and everything on set for, 60 days. That's a big budget. And we mentioned that Scott Rudin was producing that. And Scott Rudin also was in the news this week with the announcement with the announcement of Shuffle Along closing. Matt, can you give an off your top of your head kind of summary of what's happened with Shuffle Along?
When Shuffle Along was originally announced, it came with the caveat that six-time Tony winner Audra McDonald would be leaving the show for about 3 months, starting actually, it would have already happened by now, because she was going to go to London to do the West End production of Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. That obviously changed when she announced that she was pregnant. So what they did was they pushed back her leaving date. It was supposed to be July 24th. And they announced that Rhianna Giddens, who's a well-known singer, would be joining the cast and replacing her for the however long the maternity leave would be. And perhaps Savion Glover would be joining the cast as well. And we've seen that Shuffle Along has been right around $1 million a week. I don't think it's crossed $1 million yet, but it's been pretty close within, $20,000 of breaking the $1 million mark. But this week, and what was really a surprising move, they announced that they would close on July 24th, which is the day that Audra's maternity leave begins. James, we speculated that obviously the advance sales for when she's out were not very good, and they felt like they had to close. Since then, a lot of people online have really kind of taken offense to the way that Rudin's announcement was worded, that kind of they thought that he was blaming the closing on Audra getting pregnant. I have to admit, I sympathize with what they're saying. I didn't think it read like that, but that's just me, and I'm very likely wrong in my male privilege here that I don't understand that. But to me, what it sounded like was that when I read that, that what he was saying was that they planned on her being out for 3 months. That was in the plans. And to me, it sounded like the maternity leave is going to be longer than 3 months, which is something they hadn't planned on. And that the advance ticket sales weren't enough to cover the difference between what they had planned and what they had on reserve. So to me, that's how it read. And like I said, I fully accept the fact that I am blind to this, to the words that he used, but either way, I'm disappointed. James, I know you loved the show. Peter, I believe you liked it as well. So it's really disappointing that this show, which is something that I think probably did take a lot of star power to get done, whether it was Audra or Stokes or Billy Porter or George C. Wolfe and Savion Glover on the creative side to make this happen. So it's sad that it has a shortened run, no matter what the circumstances are.
I wonder how much of this has to do with word of mouth and a different type of word of mouth. I'm not even sure word of mouth means anything anymore, because I do feel that people call up and say, I saw the greatest show last night. And in the old days, people would say, oh, OK, I'm going to go. But now people say, oh, that's nice because I can't afford to go. Well, anyway, my point is, I wonder how many people have called up and their friends and said, hey, I saw Shuffle Along last night. And Audra really doesn't have that much to do, comparatively speaking, to what we're used to seeing her doing. And I wonder if that's been a nail in the coffin for this show. It really is an ensemble show. And the sad thing about it is it wouldn't be the greatest loss of the world for not to have her in it and to have anybody else take the part and be competent in it. It's an ensemble show. So it's sort of sad that that's the way it played out. And I am convinced that one reason Audra McDonald did not get a Tony nomination had nothing to do with the quality of what she was doing up there, but had to do with the size of the role.
Yeah. I think that Scott Rudin kind of unfortunately put his foot in his mouth and, you know, in kind of more or less saying that Audra being out is caused ticket sales to drop. If he had said, you know, and everybody I think would have understood this if he had said, you know, we have no, you know, we got X number, what'd they get? 10 Tony Award nominations. They came away with no Tony Awards. We have nothing to market on here. Ticket sales are not going great. And so we feel it's time to close the show instead of putting it at the feet of Audra McDonald. That was an unfortunate choice of words, I think.
Well, I also think, though, the fact that granted, they have a bunch of stars, so who knows what their running costs are in terms of salaries and everything else. But they're doing fairly well. I mean, much better than pretty much any other. Much better than the shows that have closed. I mean, and it's right up there comparable with Waitress. And again, running costs are different for every show. But I think if he would have just said, well, we aren't making enough money, I think that would have rung hollow for people. I think he could have avoided it.
I think that advanced sales, they say, are just non-existent for this show. Everybody's agreeing that they're okay right now, or else he would have closed it yesterday. He wouldn't have kept on running it if ticket sales weren't good. But the advance is terrible.
Well, and I'm not by no means mean to be a Scott Rudin apologist, because he is not a guy that necessarily endears himself to a lot of people in the community. So that's not what I'm trying to do here. But I do wonder if he wouldn't have brought up her pregnancy and just said, we're closing on July 24th, the date that she's going on maternity leave. I wonder if the same reaction would have happened anyway, because, oh, he wouldn't even say it. He wouldn't even acknowledge it. It's, closing it on that day is tantamount to blaming Audra. I think he went, you know, in his statement, he went out of his way to talk about what an important part she's been to creating this show and how excited they are for her and Will, her husband Will Swenson, to be adding a member to their family. It's almost one of those things, by closing it on July 24th, he's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. And I imagine that there would have been a negative response either way, whether he mentioned Audra's pregnancy or not. Could he have done it in a more elegant way? Of course. There's always a better way to do those types of things than how it happened. But to me, again, it just didn't read like he was blaming Audra, saying, oh, you shouldn't get pregnant. What are you doing? You're letting down this show. The statement just didn't read like that to me.
No. And I don't think it did. But I think that they were probably needed a speechwriter to walk that line of what was really happening there. And I just think it came off all wrong. And perhaps, you know, just like the end of many shows in the past that have announced a closing, that ticket sales will spike and they'll delay the closing till Labor Day or something like that. Hopefully, you know, I know that I went out and purchased tickets for my wife didn't get a chance to see it, and I told her that she had to see it, so we're going to go back and see it again. So hopefully other people are purchasing tickets and it'll make it to Labor Day, and then some Deus Ex Machina will sweep in and it'll be one for 10 years.
As I mentioned on Today on Broadway, I know it's late and the negotiations would be tough, but I hope something like this, maybe Broadway HD starts flexing some muscles and said, we know this is closing. It's got such a great cast. Let's get this on film. That would be great. Again, super late in the game to start negotiating that, but I would love to see it. You know, that would be my chance to see the show. So I hope something like that happens.
I think this is going to be, if it does close on the 24th of July, that this is going to be one of those things we talk about in years to come of, remember Shuffle Along and what a great cast it had. All right, so before we wrap up and do trivia, I want to remind listeners you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us on Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device, and get a stream directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Matt, for me, and for Michael can be found at BroadwayRadio.com as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, give us the answer to last week's trivia.
Well, what I asked was, during the run of My Fair Lady from early 56 through late 62, I Could Have Danced All Night was heard 8 times a week. But during that run, another show used at least a little of that song. What was the show? The show was Say Darling, which played only a block away at the Antitheater. It was a comedy about the making of the pajama game, ironically enough. And what happened was a lot of women would come in, and the point was they would all use the same song to audition. And that was I Could Have Danced All Night. So that was the joke of Say Darling. Only one person got it, somebody who hasn't ever given me his or her real name. I imagine it's a he because the name is Brigadude. So that's the only one who got it. And someday I hope Brigadude comes forward and lets me know who presumably he is. This week, all right. A two-time Tony-winning composer whose shows are still running and are situated very close to each other has the same surname as the actual surname of a female character who appeared in an enormous failure that was written by a composer who's had 3 Tony-winning musicals. What's the last name of the two-time winning composer, the actual last name of the female character in The Bomb, and its composer who's had 3 Tony-winning musicals? That's the question for this week.
Okay, so if you know the answer to that question, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. Brigadude,
yeah.
Let us know who you are. And maybe we won't tell anybody. It could be Scott Rudin. What do you think?
I doubt it.
Well, now he's not emailing you, Matt. So on behalf of Matt Tamanini and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
I'm just suddenly full of change.